Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for joining our Alumni Hour, Experiences from Sub-Saharan Africa. My name is Kimberly Williams, and I am an Outreach and Recruitment Officer with the Institute of International Education. I am joined today by three of our dynamic alumni, Gareth Hale, Rita Kiriseshi, and Deborah Johnson-Raw. Before we get started, I just wanted to make sure that everyone can hear us and see the PowerPoint and video. So if you wouldn't mind just typing in the chat box that you can indeed hear us before we move forward. So before we get started with our alumni, I wanted to give a brief mission and history of the Fulbright program. The Fulbright program is a cultural exchange program that was established in 1946 by Congress. The program is sponsored by the U.S. Department of State. In partnership with over 160 countries, Fulbright offers faculty and administrators such as yourself opportunities to study, teach, and/or research abroad. Our mission, which you will hear pretty often throughout your experience with Fulbright, is to foster mutual understanding between nations, advance knowledge across communities, and improve lives around the world. And that really is the core and heart of Fulbright. Diversity and inclusion is at the forefront of our mission. We encourage all those that qualify for Fulbright to participate. Currently, we are actively recruiting faculty and administrators from community colleges, minority-serving institutions, as well as rural institutions. I'd like to point your attention to the screen. Opportunities are open to people regardless of their race, color, national origin, sex, age, religion, geographic location, socioeconomic status, disability, sexual orientation, and gender identity. So I am very excited to have our alumni introduce themselves, and we will start with Gareth. Gareth?
Yeah, hello, everyone. I am teaching currently at Texas State. I teach music performance, and intro to fine art. Specifically, I'm a professional bassoonist, so I play with the symphony, opera, ballet, and my Fulbright experience was in Tanzania, and my particular it was an all discipline award, and my particular experience was 80% teaching and 20% research. And in the teaching, I had a little bit of experience with the university where I was going, and I knew what courses they needed. So I ended up teaching civil theory courses, ear training courses, and a writing about music or kind of a music business type course. And then for my research, I spent most of my career doing woodwind quintets and specifically creating platforms for new composers to create new woodwind quintets. So in Tanzania, I was able to go and work with the young composers that were around actually in a 5-country radius. And worked with composers there, and they created pieces for woodwind quintet that they were then premiered in Arusha, Tanzania, and we were able to fly, the embassy was able to fly all the composers in, and I was able to coerce my friends from woodwind quintet to all perform the premieres, the world premieres there at the in Arusha. So that was a pretty exciting research project that I was able to do. We were able to publish those, the printed version and the recordings. And many of those composers went on to graduate school in Europe and the U.S. after that. It was a big boom for them. The teaching was extremely rewarding. And I think one of the important things that I'd like to impart with you all is I am a professional bassoonist, but in East Africa, there's no place for professional, you know, bassooning, basically. There are no professional orchestras. So I was able to use a lot of my experience as a music faculty member at Texas State University to teach there in at Macomera University, and it was a very fulfilling experience. So, all right, thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Next, we have Rita Kiriseshi.
Hi. I'm an associate professor of English at the University of Oklahoma, and I work issues on race and ethnicity in the American literary context and research and teaching the fields of African and African diaspora literary and cultural studies. I spent a year in Burkina Faso. I did 50% research and 50% teaching. And I was placed in an Anglophone Studies department at the University of Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso. And I taught two courses. I taught a course on Harlem Renaissance, and I taught a course on literary and critical theory. And I studied my research on African cinema while there. And my visit coincided with the biannual Pan-African Film Festival, FESPACO, which I participated in. I had several hundred students in each class, about 200 in the Harlem Renaissance Senior Seminar, and about 600 in the theory intro class. I also organized a film series for my students that was augmented my classes, and students invited their friends, and I usually had about 300 or 400 students who came, and I was projecting at night on the wall of the Goethe Institute, which is located on campus. I felt very integrated into community. Because there was another Fulbrighter at that time, I didn't get to stay in the university Fulbright house, but I actually stayed in the neighborhood, and I commuted there. So I felt very integrated, both with the university, but also with the community. I advised master's students, and many of them went on to PhD programs in the U.S. I'm still in contact with them, and I'm still in contact with my colleagues. So that's just a brief overview. Thank you.
Thank you, Rita. And finally, we have Deborah Johnson-Ross.
Hi, everyone. Happy to be with you this afternoon. So I'm a comparative political scientist by training, although now I currently work at Baltimore City Community College, and I run their Mayor Scholars Program, which is the version of Free Community College here in Baltimore. So I'm happy to talk about that in another setting. My field research was in Cameroon, and I was fortunate enough to be able to go back to Cameroon as a Fulbrighter. I worked at the University of Boya, and I was a lecturer. I was a lecturing award, and I taught in the departments of history and political science. Similar to what Rita referenced, the classes were very large. The University of Boya was the only Anglophone university in the Central African subregion at the time, and so there were students who came from all around who wanted to have their education in English, and so I was from a very small college, McDaniel College, but when I was at the University of Boya, I taught classes of 500 students, 300 students. So it was actually a great experience as a political scientist. The other thing that was really wonderful for me is that the students went on strike soon after I arrived, and so I was able to do some research, and I shouldn't make it sound like it was an easy strike. It was a strike where there was not a lot of bloodshed or damage, so let me say that. But I was able to do some research and got some publications out of that. I did some additional work for a lot of local organizations, teaching social science research, particularly qualitative research methods. And I also worked with a Commonwealth professor from Kenya to develop a series of workshops on entrepreneurship and community service, and was able to return to Cameroon a number of times to continue that work. I also took students back to Cameroon and some other African countries as well on study tours, and continue my relationships there today, my research partner is still there, and we have a number of publications together. Cameroon is a place where I will always have an ongoing connection. I think many Fulbrighters feel that way. It is like a second home. And I'm just really fortunate to have had the experience there. So I'll stop there.
Thank you, Deborah. As a reminder, if you have any questions for our guests, you can use the questions box throughout the presentation to ask your questions. At the end, we will have a Q&A session. So I will start with you, Darris. If you can talk a little bit about your path to Fulbright, how did you decide to apply for a Fulbright, and what were some of the factors you considered before applying?
I had had some interesting experiences in my life that led me to look for a little bit more perspective and travel, and in particular immersion experience. I had played a concert in East Africa, and I was really fascinated with the people, and so I was looking for an experience, an immersion experience there, and I was very lucky, I was very fortunate that when I returned home a few days later, there was this email in my inbox that said, hey, you should consider applying for Fulbright, and it was from our campus liaison. So I want to encourage all of you out there who are curious about Fulbright to get in touch with your campus liaison. They may be a wonderful, tremendous resource for you to help. And I was very lucky, mine was. And he said, you should absolutely do this, and kind of walked me through the process. And that was, it was great timing in many regards, because I had just enough information about the university where I was getting the letter of invitation from. I knew the kind of things they needed, and I knew that I would be a good fit. And then with an all-discipline award, I was able to basically tailor-make my proposal where it fit to what they requested I could do. And so, and they also worked with me on that letter. That letter took a while, but we were able to get a great letter. So it was pretty exciting to do that. And my kids were smaller at the time. They were elementary school. They were easy to travel. It was, you know, those types of things. I'm currently the campus liaison where I work now, and people always ask me about, what about pets? And, you know, my mom took one pet, and then we sold one car, and then we did, you know, rented our house out, those types of things. So, you know, when people think about what factors to consider, you know, Fulbright was very generous, and they took care of international school for our children. So that was no problem. They were anxious and ready to go, and my kids have grown up knowing that the world is available to them. And it was an incredible experience for my children to be living abroad. And our children were also the gateway to community while we were there. They were the ones who instantly made friends. And so then we made friends with all of their friends' parents, types of things. So that was an incredible experience as well. So it's if you have family and you have kids, man, it is, you're right, you should go. It is an incredible experience in that regard. My kids are in high school now. It'd be a little harder to get them out during high school times, but Fulbright is set for family experiences, and I can highly recommend it. Thank you.
Thank you, Darris. Rita, how did you decide to apply for Fulbright, and what were some of the factors you considered?
So my path to ending up in Burkina Faso was quite interesting, because at that point I was still working on Caribbean project, an African diaspora Caribbean project, and I actually wanted to go to Trinidad, and I applied to go to Trinidad, but once my application was reviewed and it was clear that at that point in the Caribbean, they were more interested in criminologists and people who worked on AIDS research. For someone in the humanities, I was not a good fit. But Fulbright called me, and they said, well, there's this opportunity to go to Burkina Faso. which has an American Studies program, UN and American East, and you have some French. Would you be interested in going? So mine was kind of an interesting way, and this is, I'm just saying this, that I'm encouraging people to write applications that open them up to other opportunities. And because, as it turned out, this was very serendipitous, I ended up in the place where I had to be, I wanted to be eventually, and my research really changed with that. And so it became a wonderful opportunity, something I didn't think of. But Fulbright, because they read my application carefully, my African diaspora connections and capacities I could offer, and the needs in Ouagadougou, it was a really good match. I did not think about going on a Fulbright until I became tenured. And that was kind of an issue in a sense that I'm probably one of the handful of Fulbright professors at the University of Oklahoma. And people who had Fulbright, they had it decades before. So the administration had no clue how to deal with me, how to resolve the issue of am I going to take leave of absence, and what they're going to do with my classes, how they're going to pay me. And also knew that I was concerned with my tenure. I was afraid to go before tenure. I think it's probably different for other people, but in my case, it's kind of a wise decision to get tenure and then start thinking about it. So within 2 years of my tenure, I did apply and ended up in Ouagadougou. And now my research is really, and my teaching has completely switched and kind of closing the circle between the Americas and Africa. So I was very grateful for Fulbright for reading my application so carefully and offering me an option, which actually became a perfect opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Rita. Deborah, how did you decide to apply for Fulbright?
So I knew about Fulbright, and I think in a very different way from Rita, I had my Fulbright before I got tenure, and that was strategic on my part because I'm a comparativist, and I had worked in Cameroon before this. But what was different is that all of my visits to Cameroon prior to my Fulbright had been relatively short term. I had never stayed more than 6 months. And so I really wanted the Fulbright so that I could be there for an extended period of time. And the Fulbright allowed me to actually live in the country. So prior to Fulbright, I had always lived in someone else's family home, had different lodging arrangements. But when I knew that with Fulbright, I would find my own place, buy my own furniture, shop in the market for myself. It was a much more immersive process, and that is what I was looking for. One of the things I will say to the folks listening in is your Fulbright application is not always successful the first time. It's a highly competitive process, and one of the things that you will learn is that sometimes not getting selected is not because you don't have a strong application. As both Darris and Rita have mentioned, there are in-country considerations that impact the choice of a Fulbrighter. So for me, going to Cameroon, as I mentioned, University of Boya was the only Anglophone university. And the first time I applied for a Fulbright, they had a number of people at the University of Boya at the time that I applied. And so the country commission decided the University of Boya didn't need anyone else that year, and so I did not get selected. But I also happened to have taken a student group that year, and while I was there with the students, I told everybody I met that I was applying for Fulbright for the next round, and I got selected. So, but I also had an opportunity to tailor my application to what I knew they were looking for that next time around. So I think, you know, I just knew that I needed to go back and spend that extended amount of time. And just in terms of factors to consider, I think considering your family situation is important. But also, it's just really important to maintain that openness and really focus on what may help you in the long run. Because sometimes I think we can be really focused on the short term, but really think about what might help you in the long run and be open to suggestions from others.
Thank you, Deborah. In terms of the application process, we have a couple of questions. How did you select your country and award, and how did you select your host institution?
You want me
okay.
to continue?
We can start with you, Darris. We can go in the same order.
Okay.
Okay, so I had some experiences in East Africa, and I had traveled through Tanzania on a tour, and so I was familiar with the country. I fell in love with the people. And I found a small institution in Arusha area that had a music program. And then I made connections with the leader of that music program, his chair of the department, and said, hey, I'm interested in this. You know, can you help with the letter? And he was very positive about it. And so I continued that relationship for, you know, about 9 months until I could submit my application. And of course, it's another 9 months before you hear. And then I was able to travel. So I had made a little bit of a contact just a few days traveling through, but I had learned what the institution needed, the institution that where I was a good fit, that had a school of music. And of course, I fell in love with the people in Tanzania and wanted to take my family there. Traveling to sub-Saharan Africa, you know, I have plenty of friends in the U.S. and at my own institution that say, why would you want to do that? But after I'd been through that area, I was like, I definitely want to do this. This is incredible. And it was. It was absolutely, people say, are you worried about this or safety and the kids and that? It's, no, it was completely worth it. So, you know, if you're thinking about sub-Saharan Africa, don't let your friends who've never traveled out of the U.S. talk you out of it. So it's an incredible experience, and we were very careful to make sure that we were in safe locations, that we had great water and resources. It was an incredible experience, especially with the kids. The biggest advice that I have to give, probably on project statement application, is we worked really hard to make sure the letter of invitation said that they need A, B, C, D, and that I could provide A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K. You know, that I could provide what they need plus more. I think it's a really common experience for Fulbrighters to go abroad and to be asked, hey, can you teach this as well, or can you teach this? And most Fulbrighters will be like, yeah, sure. I mean, I'll give it a try. And I think that's the norm, kind of. So to say that you're willing, ready and willing, to do, and that's the way I was. I ended up teaching a ton of classes, and some that I might not have felt completely qualified for if it's back in the States, but I was willing. They needed somebody to do it, and I said, yes, of course I will. I'll give it my best shot. So I think that's kind of an attitude of a Fulbrighter, and that would be my recommendation on that. I think that's it for those questions. Thank you.
Rita, would you mind sharing?
So, because for me it was kind of a backwards process that Burkina chose me. I had to choose Burkina. So And I had to sort of retool and kind of do my project backwards. I asked Fulbright to give me some contacts. So they actually provided me with the contact phone numbers and the project descriptions and evaluation of the who will stay of previous Fulbrighters in Burkina Faso. And that became a very enormous resource to me. And I'm still friends with several of the people who were previous Fulbrighters in Burkina, and I learned quite a bit ahead. And then I talked with friends. I started reading everything I could about Burkina Faso, its history, its culture. And so I kind of prepared myself through it. Within a week, I accepted this option. I was in contact with the chair of the Anglophone Studies Department, and we were constantly communicating how to make it work, what kind of classes they needed, what were the resources. So it's just to say again, to reiterate, that flexibility is very important, and it just would lend you opportunities you couldn't even have thought of before. And also, I think this is a nice resource to kind of create that community. And that was my first contact with Fulbrighters, to know that this is really a little bird in itself. And you can count. And I inherited friends from previous Fulbrighters. So once I arrived, I had built-in friends and who sort of waited for me, who I could. So I felt very integrated even before I landed. That's what I contribute now.
Thank you. Debbie, would you mind sharing?
Yes, so I'm sure that everyone can tell by now. I was already quite familiar with Cameroon. But I will say that I didn't, as I pursued my graduate studies, I did not know much about Cameroon. And as a political scientist, Cameroon is just a fascinating country. It's one of the African countries that has a tri-colonial heritage. It was just, and it still fascinates me today because it defies every political theory that you're taught as a student. And so I already had the connection with the country. And in fact, the University of Goya was my host institution when I was doing my dissertation fieldwork. However, coming back a number of years later as an instructor was a very different experience. But as I said, I really wanted the experience of being able to live there for an extended period of time. Just in terms of advice about the application process, I think it's really important to be tuned in, as others have said, to what the institution or the country is looking for. And you'll find that information in all of the background information that Fulbright provides. Your project statement needs to be really tight and specific. You have a very short amount of space to get to make a huge impact. But the other thing I would like for people to think about is when you're deciding where you want to apply, you should look at the previous awards for previous couple of years. And I would consider places that have a need that you can fulfill but may not have had very many Fulbrighters in the last couple of years. Like, you really have to have a strategy. So even though I went to a country that I was familiar with, I would have been open to going to a different country. It just aligned that they had a need that I could fulfill at the time that I was applying. But you should really be thoughtful and strategic so that if there's another country that you have not considered, but they have a need, consider going there and doing the research and figuring out if that's a place that you can go, but make sure that your project statement has high impact and is very strategic.
Thank you, Deborah. And just to piggyback off of a couple of points that Deborah made, we do have our scholar directory. So if you're on our website, cies.org, it's going to be the third tab underneath the graphic. It is our Fulbright Scholar Directory. It holds all of the alumni information for our scholars for the past 10 years. It's a great way to filter by country to get a good idea of which institutions are hosting scholars and how often. You can filter out the results and sort the years chronologically so you can see which institutions have hosted in previous years. And that gives you a good idea of potential institutions for affiliation. And again, you can see how often they've hosted in the last 10 years. And finally, your experience in country. What are some of the benefits of doing research and teaching on a Fulbright? How did the U.S. Embassy engage with you? And what was something that impressed you most about your colleagues and students? We can start with you, Darren.
Sure. I want to tack on one other thing that for that last question that we were talking about. I had actually submitted two letters of invitation at two different institutions, and so that made my application more flexible, I guess, in a way, because there were two institutions in the country that had music programs. And I think, and the reason that I did that was because the regional program officer at CIES at the time had told me, you know, that institution, we're not sure we're going to send somebody there. So I would like to encourage all of you, it benefited me tremendously, is to make friends with that regional program officer because they know the lay of the land. And they can say, hey, you know, this institution may be more likely to get somebody. This institution may, they had someone last year or something like that. And that's the advice that I received, and I was able to follow through with that. So it was very successful for me. So I would like to encourage you all to do that. Benefits of research and teaching. Well, it was incredibly rewarding. And to the students that I was working with were desperate for education. And it was like a double-edged sword. They were incredibly thankful for the education that they were receiving to the point, I mean, these were people who were maybe getting one meal a day. I would take bananas to most of my classes, and I never went home with a single banana because they were, I mean, they weren't getting very much food because they were investing all their money in their education and their educational resources. Many of my students had forsaken their villages and their home life because of the attitude towards education. The elders thought that they should stay there and take care of them and the village and not go off to university. But most of my students had in their mind that once they became educated, they were going to go back and then help their village. So, but there was a stigma attached, so they did feel a little bit of guilt. And I guess in that regard, I was, you know, I mean, I just felt incredibly privileged in my life that I didn't have to work against the same hurdles that my students did. And so we just worked endlessly to make sure that they understood the concepts, that they could write down the music, notate the music. And African music in general is amazing. East African music is not as prevalent in Western studies, so it's kind of underrepresented. And so that was a big benefit as well, because now my students, we all had this mission together to basically be able to teach them how to notate music from the bush. So they would go out as basically young ethnomusicologists and go out into the bush and notate the music, video record it. But see, a person with fair skin can't do that. They're outsiders. So people used to do that, and they would go out and pay lots of money, but it was not accurate because the ethnic groups would not want to share any of that information with outsiders. So I was able to teach my students how to notate the music, how to archive it, record it. And so it was a big project that we were working on. Anthropologists say that most of the music from the bush, because of urbanization, is going to be gone in about two decades maybe. So it was I mean, there was an urgency to the whole project they were doing, and everybody was extremely excited about it. We were working, you know, from early in the morning till late in the evening, getting their skills good enough where they were the ones who could go and collect, archive, preserve their own culture. That was an incredibly rewarding project, and I was able to afterwards, after my Fulbright, to contribute to several grant writing projects that were able to create a center in that area. But we were all very passionate about this project, so it was teaching, research all together. The students were all involved with it. It was very rewarding, and the embassy was very supportive during the whole experience. When you're a Fulbrighter, you land like a rock star, basically. Especially if you're in the city where the embassy is located, you get full access to the embassy. You can use the gym. You can do whatever. I was 12 hours away by car from the embassy. The embassy still took our touring group, the university touring group, and they paid for us to go on tour around Tanzania, and we played for the president. We played at the embassy. They were very supportive of the Fulbrighters, and it was through the public affairs office at that embassy. So it was, and then I had a friend who was a Fulbrighter who was counting chameleons in Western Africa, and they put big photos of the chameleons all around the embassy at the time. It was incredible. I mean, like portrait-style photos, museum-type photos of these chameleons. So the embassy is incredibly supportive, in my experience, of the Fulbrighters, and you just have to tap their shoulder and say, hey, you're kind of the face of the educational force of America at the time. So they want to show you off. They want to do cool things. And they were very supportive of me and my Fulbright friends as well. So recommend it. Thanks.
Thank you. Rita, would you mind sharing?
Yes. My experiences were a little bit different, but I will start with the benefits of doing research and teaching on a Fulbright. First of all, I very much appreciated the funding they gave, like to be able to be there and be integrated and teaching and working, and also the money they gave me to bring books. And I brought all the books with me that I could and I was going to teach, and even that was not enough. Because of the big class sizes. And to the credit of my students, they organized themselves into reading brigades. They shared the books. They had a schedule. They got on mopeds, delivered the books to each other. But I appreciated that financial support that Fulbright provided to actually aid the education. When I arrived on September 1st, the university was on strike, and they were still, because of that, they were still finishing the previous year. So I did not start teaching for quite a while. But within 24 hours, even though the university was not in session for my term, students found me and they involved me right away. They actually involved me before the faculty. And they had a very lively Anglophone Studies English club with weekly meetings, and they invited me every Thursday to participate. They had picnics and cultural events, and I was very much involved with the students. Once the education process restarted, I never thought this would fall out of my mouth, but I loved the faculty meetings, which I don't think I've said since. But the faculty meetings were just wonderful because it was just very collegial, and literally people were sharing, and everyone was trying. It's very, in a way, make the schedule work for everyone. There was a classroom shortage, so we constantly had to negotiate who's going to use a classroom at what time, and who had some family obligation, who needed what. And so the students were wonderful, but the faculty just showed me how to be an academic in a different kind of context of learning about the care. If there was a family event, the whole faculty showed up for each other's event, a birth or a death. And So that was a very much of an inclusive experience. And if I would have gone as a tourist, I would not have had that. And I felt very much integrated because of that. I was integrated into my neighborhood I lived. And there were several political unrests, and we were under state of emergency a few times. And it's your neighbors you rely on. And I felt like I felt very secure. That I was not alone, in a sense that even though we had no water, no electricity, nothing was working, we were under curfews and just sitting out with the neighbors. And in terms of the embassy, even though the embassy was in Ouagadougou, but because of the terrorist attack before, they literally bunkered and they were in a different part of Ouagadougou and was actually difficult to get to. And the support I got was pretty much about I could cash checks, so I could get money, and also I could get mail, and I could get packages through them. But otherwise, they were very much in a sort of bunker mode and very sort of separated out of the community. And because they had the books that some of the previous Fulbrighters brought, it became kind of difficult to access that, but to the credit of my students, on their mopeds and bicycles, they did the long ride out and created those possibilities to share the books. The embassy a few times arranged cultural programs when they invited me and invited some of the students, but I felt very separate, and they made it very clear that Fulbright is kind of an independent. And even though we were somewhat connected to the embassy, we were mostly connected if there was kind of an emergency. I think that I stop here.
Can you hear me?
Now, yes. Hi.
Okay. I couldn't hear anything for a second, so okay. Good.
Okay. Thank you. Debbie, would you mind sharing?
Sure. So, you know, the benefits are just immeasurable depending on, you know, what you're doing. I've been sort of rethinking what I was going to say as I was listening to Darris and Rita. You know, I think that it's difficult for you to imagine what the benefits are going to be before you go, because you cannot predict. You don't know what's going to happen when you get there. And so even though, like I've mentioned a number of times, I was very familiar with Cameroon, but there's no way I could have predicted what my Fulbright experience was going to be. I thought I knew, but it was very different from what I thought I was going to do. And so being there during a student strike, I was very much set on the idea of teaching there. That was the thing I really wanted to do. Although, you know, you always have opportunities to do some kind of research. No matter what kind of award you have, you find the time, that kind of thing. But I ended up doing research that I could not have predicted I would have been able to do. I found a research partner, and as a matter of fact, we have communicated through WhatsApp even today. So, you know, you have these ongoing, lasting relationships that develop. I've got people who have said to me, there's land for you, all of those kinds of things. And I think those are the kinds of connections that most Fulbrighters treasure in terms of, or people who have a good Fulbright experience. So, you know, teaching the huge classes was really different for me. But what was a great experience was having those classes do experiential learning. Like I was able to do things with those huge classes that I did with my small classes. Now, my Cameroonian friends told me I was crazy and I wasn't going to be able to do those things, and I did them anyway. But I also learned how to do some things that my Cameroonian colleagues were doing. And it was just an experience that I really can't totally articulate. What I will say about it, though, is that the depth of integration is something that you really can't imagine. And I know I'm being a little bit repetitive, but it's because I'm also thinking, probably because I've been in touch with my research partner this morning, and many of you may know that Cameroon, for the first time since its independence, is going through some turmoil, probably I'm maybe a little bit emotional because they are still having, they call them ghost towns and things like that, where everybody shuts down. And so I'm thinking about some of those experiences that my friends there are going through right now. One of the things, I think particularly because I'm a Black American, I did have some different experiences. At the time, there had not, at the time that I went, this is no longer true, but at the time that I went as a Fulbrighter, there had not been very many Black Americans who had been there as Fulbrighters. And so that was an interesting experience because people had very different expectations of how I might integrate and behave based on my identity. And so I ended up becoming sort of an official expert on people like Toni Morrison and, you know, African-American authors, because there was this assumption that because I was African-American, I would be able to talk about anything African-American, even though it wasn't my expertise. And so that's how the embassy used me. The embassy, I was actually quite engaged with the embassy. And I did, I probably have a list of like 30 events I did that year, totally based on the fact that I was African-American and not that I was an Africanist by training. I had the opportunity to travel to Ethiopia as well. When you're a Fulbrighter, other countries can request you to come speak or participate in conferences and panels and things like that based on your expertise. And so there were some events happening in Ethiopia, and they asked if I could come. So I went, I think, probably for 2 or 3 weeks to Ethiopia while I was a Fulbrighter. And that was a very interesting experience for me. But I was in a very different way than Rita has expressed. I was very much integrated into the embassy and worked with them almost probably every 2 or 3 weeks I was doing something for the embassy. I loved my time in Cameroon, and it is the place that I will go when I retire. So I'll stop there.
Thank you, Deborah. Okay, so it's time for the Q&A session. I'm pulling up your questions now, and I see a couple of questions that revolve more specifically towards your applications. So for questions like that, I'm able to answer them. I just want to remind you, if your question does not get answered today, every Wednesday until applications are due September 15th, we will be having the Sub-Saharan Africa Advising Hour every Wednesday between 11 and 12 Eastern Standard Time. So do sign up for tomorrow's session if you don't get your question answered. So I will start with the first question. So this is for the entire panel. How difficult is it to acquire an invitation from an institution when you don't have a previous connection?
So I'm going to, I'll just say that based on what I know from other friends and colleagues, what I would do is look at, as we've referenced before, the different institutions and what they're looking for, and reach out. And of course, the Fulbright professionals can assist you with that, but you can reach out and contact the institution and give them your background, tell them what you're able to do, ask them what you can do for them. And sometimes whether or not it is difficult depends on that specific situation. But I think that you have to be motivated, and you have to be willing to make that first contact, and you have to talk to the Fulbright folks and get their support when you're making that kind of outreach effort.
I had two letters, and each letter took probably 3 months each. It moved very slowly. I mean, I was surprised how slowly it was. I was warned in advance that it would move slowly, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. But just the way things are, I did get the letters, and I had to be very careful. They were through email, but I had to be very careful about who I put in the two, you know, when sending an email, what order I put the people that I was copying the email to. And I had never thought of that before, and then someone luckily explained that to me. Make sure you put the most important person first with the highest rank and then the next person, or else your email will be ignored. So that was an experience that I had. And I never got a response from an email that I didn't CC someone on. And some of these were, one of them was a complete cold call email, and I did finally get, I had to follow up on it a ton. But once I figured out the protocol and how to do it and put greetings at the top of the letter and proper etiquette, then I finally was able to get my letters. So it took a while, but I was able to do it.
Okay. Rita, did you have anything?
I didn't have to go through this process, but since I've been involved with Fulbright ever since my own award, I've seen different examples. And one issue is about the websites. Some of the universities have really good websites. I visited Ghana, and Ghana has good websites, but Burkina Faso and University of Ouagadougou doesn't. And so that's one issue. There's usually a cultural connection, like the embassy has a local Fulbright person, and that person would have the most knowledge in terms of which institution would be open to a Fulbrighter. So kind of maybe it's a good idea to start with that person through the embassy. And then just kind of, it's kind of a detective work to find the right person who has something in common with you in terms of your interest. And then just kind of keep reaching out. That's all I have to say.
Okay. And this is a question for the entire panel. What were some of the outside activities that you were engaged in outside of your host institution?
Since I had a woodwind quintet that traveled from the U.S. to come over and premiere the works, we took advantage of that opportunity, and we played at numerous orphanages and hospitals in the area, a couple of concerts for expats. We played for everybody we could, and that was very rewarding. We also went on tour to the embassy, and we also took a musical group, so the embassy was able to help with that. On weekends, I would take family. We'd go on little family vacations and travel around. You're not allowed to leave the country unless you have special permission, like you're going on to a conference and the embassy knows about it. But we did a lot of adventuring as well.
So. I because the university was delayed, I took a bus trip down to Accra and Cape Coast, and I actually took all my trips in the country and to Ghana on the bus, and I feel like I learned a lot. So I had a good understanding of the layout of Burkina Faso, just to get to know the different parts of it. And it has 64 ethnicities, and each region has its own, of course, languages and ethnicities. I am very much like music, so I went almost every day some kind of a musical event. And the French Cultural Center is actually quite Burkinabe in a sense of we had local musicians play almost every night. So that the music, there was also a lot of art exhibits. I lived in the neighborhood which has the biggest sort of craft conference within walking distance. And of course, there was the International Film Festival, which I was really lucky to be able to go. And I had some friends who lived, one person lived in Sierra Leone, one in Ghana, and one in Togo. And I had visitors during Festival. So people came to me as well. And but every night there was some kind of an event to go to, and it was literally walking distance and even just a little resto and with music. So I think that was probably the most enjoyable part of my stay, is to be constantly surrounded by music and art and just life there. And I'm glad I got to go to Ghana. I didn't get to go to Mali because that's when Al-Qaeda started. So at that point, it was not safe to go. So that's my kind of, I wish I could have. Mm-hmm. Debbie?
I'll say something very quick. So I did similar things. I traveled around the country. I had guests from the U.S. And actually some other countries come visit me while I was there. I actually had a group of students from my home institution come while I was there. But I will say the most fun I had was I had a friend, so this was at a time when they were just getting Wi-Fi, and not a lot of people knew how to use Google and things like that. Like, there are people there who think I'm a computer genius, which is hilarious, but I taught classes. I had a friend who owned an internet cafe that was a social enterprise, and the money went to support vulnerable children. And so every Sunday for about 4 months, we taught 100 people. We would have 100 students come in. I would stand on top of a table. They would be crowded around the computers, and we taught them how to get an email address, some email protocol and courtesy, and how not to look for partners, but how to do research on the internet. And then we taught them about internet resources that were free to African universities and those kinds of things. And that was probably the most fun and rewarding thing. And after that, I could go through town. Everybody knew who I was. I didn't know who any of them were, but because there were so many. But it was absolutely an amazing and fun experience. And I did that every Sunday morning for a good little while.
Thank you, Deborah. Unfortunately, everyone, we are out of time. I'd like to ask the panelists, we do have some specific questions that are for each of you. Is it okay if our attendees email you directly with any specific questions?
Absolutely.
Okay. So before we go, we'll go around really quickly. Is there any final advice you'd like to give to any prospective applicant?
I would just say apply. Apply. It's a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah, I say start the process now and keep applying till you go. I mean, you'll never regret paying taxes ever again in this country. It is completely worth it. It's awesome. Transformational. I mean, it's incredible.
Awesome. My advice is flexibility. I felt like that was the biggest most important thing in the sense that just go with, because things, situations change day by day, minute by minute, and including where I ended up in Burkina as opposed to Trinidad. But from then on, it's an adventure. Embrace it and just open to it. And because it's an opportunity that doesn't come your way very often. It's a lifetime experience.
Thank you, Rita, and thank you to the entire panel for joining us today. We really appreciate it. And for our attendees, just some last-minute ways to stay connected with us. If you have any questions about the application process or about your application materials, you can email me at subsaharanafrica@iie.org. I am the recruitment lead. Also, one final reminder, on Wednesdays, which is tomorrow, we do have our advising session from 11 to 12 Eastern Standard Time, so I do hope to see you all then. And thank you so much for attending. This webinar has been recorded, and it will be available on our website in about 4 to 5 days, so do check back. And thank you so much for attending. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.